I'm Chris Sharon, and I, together with Sonia, my wife, serve the village as teaching staff coordinators this summer, which is a really fun role. And one of the fun parts is trying to spark conversations on different themes that are running through the life of the village. And tonight was an opportunity to talk about something that has been coming up in a number of different ways, one of which was a South African Bible study leader, Alan Story, who was here over a couple of weeks and reminded us, many of us, of the power of insightful commentary about America from the perspective of someone from somewhere else. And he challenged us to think about a citizenship that's not wrapped in our flag, but wrapped in our baptism, wrapped in our common identity as being created in the image of God, in, by, and for love. And not just in a sort of Pollyanna-ish way, but in a really hard-nosed way that realizes why we build the B-52 bomber in a whole bunch of different states so that there isn't one facility that could be targeted, but it requires many in order to be built. Anyway, those questions came up. And a couple of years ago, an Irishman was surprisingly giving the homily at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C. An Irishman who you wouldn't ordinarily expect to be giving a homily, he said, "I'm not a man of the cloth unless that cloth is leather." That was Bono, the lead singer for U2. And one of the themes he's been speaking about recently is that brand America isn't faring very well around the world. And he thinks there are some specific things we could do about it, one of which is learn more about the rest of the world and care about it in a way that shows that we want to be servants and partners with the rest of the world instead of stepping on them. So in the context of those kinds of themes, both raised in our national life and here in the last couple weeks at Holden, I wanted to invite some of the young adults who are on staff and who have spent time studying and working abroad to reflect on ways in which that experience has changed them, changed their sense of being an American, and changed their sense of what it means to be a citizen connected to their Christian faith and connected to their sense of their lives. And they'll do it in their own ways, each of them, as a way to spark our general conversation about the importance of this global connection in our sense of citizenship. So I'm grateful for them doing it. Andrew and Greta Willis, and Greta Stieber, and Muriel, I just wrote it down.
Muriel Vinji.
Vinji, are gonna lead us off in our conversation. So thanks to all of you for agreeing to my fast and loose planning and for coming to start us off. So in any order you want, share some of your thoughts and then we'll all come into the conversation.
I'm Greta Willis. I'm working in the kitchen this summer for 6 weeks. I was in China from 2002 to 2004. I was teaching English right after I graduated from St. Olaf, and it was through the ELCA, and I should say I think the ELCA does a really great job through their global missions department. And there's tons of missionary activity in China, and I think the ELCA has a really responsible model of it, doing the accompaniment model. So they sent us through a Chinese organization that was started by Chinese Christians right after China opened up. And so they had us working in the education department. I was in Jiangxi province, and that's inland a little. If you draw a line between Hong Kong and Shanghai, it's kind of right in the middle there on the Yangtze River. So my students were middle school English teachers. They were all adults, and almost all were older than me. And they were wonderful because they got a semester off from teaching, so they were happy about that. They got to come to the big city, the capital, in this very rural province. And they got to speak English. For a lot of them, it was their first time to talk with a foreigner. They've been studying English, just written English, for so long. So now the program was to build their speaking capacity so they could use that in the classroom and try to help the balance between rural education and urban education in China. That's a great imbalance to the students there. Let's see, as far as it, well, I remember when I was there, I was reading a fun travel writer, Paul Thoreau, and he wrote about, he did Peace Corps in Africa, and I remember he wrote that after 30 years of Peace Corps in Africa, Africa is probably no better off, but probably worse off, but what is better off is perhaps the U.S. Our government has more leaders in the State Department than have had time overseas. Our business leaders, some of them have had Peace Corps experience now, and so he wrote about that as the positive part of having U.S. citizens going overseas and doing this kind of work. And I felt the same about China, that I think my perspective was enlightened a lot, and it was fun to teach and be there. So I'll start there.
Good. Thanks.
You guys want to go or should I pick up?
I'm Mariel Vinci, and I studied in Germany over a course of a few years. It's a total of 1 year. I was living in Bonn independently as a student at the University of Bonn for philosophy as an exchange student with University of Wisconsin-Madison. I lived in a dorm with a diverse crowd, people from over 12 different countries around the world, and that was one of the most unique experiences I've ever had as a living space with that kind of diversity, but also our exchange program was just as diverse with 20 American students, 20 Japanese students, and then about 100 others. Some that came in groups and some that came alone from different countries too. So our interactions as Americans, we were one of the larger groups that formed cliques or didn't form cliques. And the way that we lived together and interacted together also spoke about our pride in America. How quiet did we have to live? And how did we act with other Americans who maybe weren't living as quietly as we were? Those are some of the more interesting moments. And I can talk about that later too.
Thanks.
Okay. I'm Greta Stieber, and I went on global semester with St. Olaf College. And it was a 5-month trip, and it was kind of a whirlwind. It's a long time, but it was really quick. We went to 9 different countries, started in Switzerland, and then Greece, spent a month in Egypt, a month in India, a week in Thailand, a month in Hong Kong, 2.5 weeks in China, and then a month in South Korea. So we covered a lot of bases, and we had so many experiences, but I think the most important thing for me was getting to know our own group. As Americans, studying in a group abroad and traveling as a group was much different than being on your own. And we had a very diverse group. We had several people who were adopted from South Korea and coming there and being in Asia just in general with them and discovering how they reacted and how other people reacted to us as trying to identify us as Americans and working together and discovering our own strengths, and some people who had never been abroad before, never been on airplanes before, and so just learning how your average American goes abroad and working in a group that way. So it's a good experience.
Good, thanks.
My name is Andy Willis. I'm also a St. Olaf graduate, and also went on the global semester when I was a student there. I think that experience got me interested in doing something more overseas after college. And I applied with the ELCS Division for Global Mission right after college and ended up on a 2-year placement in Jerusalem working with the Palestinian Lutheran Church. Some of you might be familiar with the ELCJ or ELCJHL, is what they're called now, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and the Holy Land. So I was working with their school system. Some of you might be, if you're familiar with the church, you might know about the schools a little bit. They have a system of 4 schools run for Palestinian children in the all in the West Bank. And the church there had requested somebody whose native language was English to come over and help handle communication issues, really, with the schools for fundraising and accompaniment type programs overseas. So I was in touch with churches from the U.S. and Scandinavia and Germany who were interested in visiting the schools or supporting the schools or engaging with the schools really in any way. I was there from 2003 to 2005 and then started the seminary right when I came back. I think what St. Olaf, what the experiences at St. Olaf studying abroad did for me, I was trying to think this through, and I think learning how to be a guest was a big part of it. I think that going abroad and spending time, significant time in another culture, it changes you somehow. And I think part of it is learning how to interact and be with people outside your home. And that's very much the posture that ELCA's mission is taking these days in the global mission department. I've already mentioned this model of accompaniment. With my position also, that position was requested by the local church. They had asked for someone to come, and the ELCA said, we'll do what we can to supply someone. That's the model that the ELCA is working for, where the request comes from the church abroad, and we send someone to accompany that church in its walk of faith and its journey there. And I think it was an exciting thing to be a part of, to be doing mission work in that way that I can get excited about, I think. Part of that learning to be a guest was going in with an attitude that God has been at work in this place to which I'm going for a long time, and God is at work there now, and God will be at work long after I go. It's not, mission isn't bringing that. It's recognizing that you're participating in the work of God in a place that God's already been at work. I feel myself rambling a little bit here, but maybe we can open it up for some comments and see where we want to go.
Good, thank you. Who has a comment or a question after hearing a little bit about where they traveled and worked and some of their initial thoughts about those experiences? Yeah, in the back here.
I'd be curious to each of you to comment on what you perceive, or actually the perception of the people that you encountered. What were their thoughts and impressions about the country of the United States? I know that, I really hate to share this with you, but I understand that one of the more popular American TV programs in Europe is the Jerry Springer Show. And I think, is that the kind of impression that the rest of the nations see and think that we're all like that? You know, which just pains me, excruciatingly so. I'd like to hear how people shared with you what they thought. What were their perceptions? What were their stereotypes? You know, are we all stinking rich? Or, you go ahead.
In Palestine, just a quick story related to yours. In Palestine, I remember hearing the story from someone, from a student in one of our schools, the school located in Bethlehem. There'd been a long curfew in Bethlehem in 2002 where people and the Palestinians were not allowed to leave their homes for pretty extended periods of time. And he said everybody got hooked on American daytime television because it was on the TV there. So people were seeing all kinds of soap operas and stuff because that's what was on their TV. I found in Palestine that people were able to make a distinction between Americans, the people, and the government, which really impressed me. I don't think I would have expected that. I think I would have imagined that, you know, if I were from that part of the world, I might have imagined that this country that, you know, supposedly a democracy, I would assume the people kind of line up with the government. And people were not making that assumption necessarily about me as a foreigner there. And I think we're more interested in engaging and finding out you know, where I stood and if all people agree with George Bush's policies and things like that. So it was, I found much more lively conversation maybe than I expected to.
I would add that it was the same way in Egypt when we were there. They didn't necessarily associate us as students with our leadership because, well, the possible reason was because they don't have direct connection with their own leadership. They assume that there isn't a, you know, democracy did not lead to us choosing necessarily who we want, which, you know, could be. But I also found that they often assumed more that, and just in terms of where we appeared, that we would be perhaps more risque, maybe. In Egypt, you have to dress modestly, and it's part of their culture. But I think they often assume that Americans are fairly slutty, and cause that's what they see on the TV. And a lot of times, it was actually the Europeans coming in there. And if you go to the beaches, it's the Europeans wearing the dainty swimming suits and so forth. And we were all in our one pieces, and they were just blown away by that, because a lot of group was maybe a little different than a lot of Americans, but I think a lot of what they see of Americans is also Europeans coming in as well. So it's just maybe just the Western culture coming in. They have a very, it's just like us coming and looking at them, and we think that they're trapped and they're behind their veil and so forth, but they see the same way of us. They think that we're trapped because we don't have the freedom to do what they can do in their own country.
In Germany, I encountered a couple of moments where popular media skewed their perception of me or me as an American. A funny moment was in a second grade classroom I was volunteering at. One of the fourth grade rambunctious kids got sent in to be watched by us, and I was just hanging out with him, and he was like, "Oh, you're from America? Oh, do you have like gangs and stuff?" Like, well, not where I live, like Midwest, nice, you know, it's no game. But he was just, he was anticipating me being like, yeah, it's really dangerous, you can't even go on the streets in the middle of the night. But he was also a fourth grader, and was kind of excited and disappointed, disappointed with my reaction about it being a little safer than that. most of the other perception issues came from politics, like the Bush. One of the first questions people ask you, no matter where they're from, was, "So, do you like Bush?" And if you said yes, you weren't their friend, and they probably wouldn't talk to you again. If you said no, then they'd be like, "Oh, okay, we can be friends." And that was a very clear moment. It was one of the first things that they would ask in the first hour surgery. And later on, before I left, they were going through primaries with Obama, and I was talking with a few of my friends, not from America, and they asked me if I thought that he'd make it, or if that America was ready. I was like, "Why wouldn't we be ready?" And she's like, I don't think you are. I don't think some people are." I'm like, "Oh, okay. All right, you can believe that." But there's just, I found myself having to stand up for my personal beliefs and distinguish those from the government. But I was surprised, as well as Andy said, that people were ready to distinguish the government from the person. But that was a good thing, but it was also a bad thing, because then they're like, "Oh, you're an exception because you're a nice girl." It wasn't like, "Oh, all Americans are like that."
Most of that applies to China too. And the general stereotype is that we were rich and fat.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, they do think it's dangerous though. Like, they wouldn't go out, they wouldn't go walking in the streets of America. There's gangs and guns and violence. And you know, for a lot of parts, it's true. I mean, the US probably has a higher crime rate than most of the world. And if you look, I don't know, there's a mess recently where they talked about the jail rate and this. I was talking about that. 1 in 100. Yeah, you were talking about that. Okay, so 1 in 100 people in America are in jail. And if you look at the rest of the world, the crime rates are way lower. A lot of petty crime, like pickpockets and that kind of thing. But there's people aren't going out and murdering each other in the streets. It just doesn't happen. So in all ways, it is true. It is more violent here, I think. But
Other comments or questions? Yeah.
I'll be at CINAHL next year, and I was just wondering if you could talk more about the global semester abroad, what that entails, what all you do with that.
I don't know if that's really, we could talk about that later. We'd love to talk about that.
Yeah, all three of us went on it, and Deanne led the trip last year.
We'll give a 1 minute version, you know.
You're in a group of.
Come on, Greta, you've had the most recent practice.
Okay, so it's a 5 month trip. We leave in September, come back at the end of January. And I already listed which countries, but those can vary depending on which teacher is leading it. We take a course on Egyptian history in Egypt, and then there's religions of India in India, and then arts of China and Hong Kong, and sociology of Korea, Korean society, I suppose, in Korea. And there's also one overarching course that is taught by the professor to lead it. Deanne taught Jesus and Cross-Cultural Perspectives, so we got a couple books for that. And we have guest lecturers in each country that come to speak to us about the topics, and tons of touring. You get to know your group very, very well. You know what color, you can see them down the street and you'll know like what shirt they're wearing, and like you see pictures of their feet and you know whatever. This is 30 people, so you're really close. That's the brief overline of the trip.
Thanks. Good. Mary Lott.
I'm wondering, how do you think your travels changed how you look at your life coming back? What has changed about your perceptions now? But maybe just one or two things.
I was anti-American before I left, and was very ready to be like, oh, I'm not a Bush lover, I'm a Bush hater. And I also didn't even like the school I was at, and I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll stay in Germany, all that kind of stuff. But halfway through that, I fell in love with my school, with America as well, because you come to realize and recognize the things you miss, the structure, and you accept that some of the problems we may have in arise are, you can't give up. That's kind of what I learned, is that you can't give up anymore. And there's something more than accepting, and it's accepting and adapting, and then being ready to change, being a leader, and coming back ready, and feeling on top of the world for that. Hmm. That happened with my faith, too. It wasn't just my politics.
I found that I think I became more maybe engaged with my community when I came back. I found that in China, that was a really good way to get into the community, was to make friends with different generations, not just my students, and it's better for learning the language because then you're not practicing English all the time. Because often Chinese would want to start discussions with Bush and the war, and I found it was a lot better. We went to aerobics class together, or I got involved with the early morning Tai Chi group of old ladies in the park, and then you get to go to their house for dinner. So I found that building relationships, starting from positive shared experiences, was something that I could bring back and to the
rest. I think it made me a better listener. I think that was a piece of the maybe learning to be a guest that I mentioned earlier. I think I learned better how to listen to people tell their own stories and try to set aside some of my own preconceptions of a situation. I found that very important in Israel Palestine, where there are a whole lot of stories, and it was. I found that engaging a person on their own past, their own story, was the best way to start gaining a perspective on the larger situation. So I think it's made me a better listener in some ways. It also, as a student of religion, I think it also really opened my eyes to the importance of context as well. I saw Palestinians reading the Bible in ways that were pretty different from the ways I'd read it, and that was both, I suppose, surprising in some ways, but really exciting in other ways, and realizing that this is a much, the Christian tradition can be a much richer engagement with context and the text and the meaning that's created there. So I've been watching Palestinians wrestle with the stories in Joshua about the Israelites' conquest of Canaan. That's a pretty tough text for Palestinians, and looking at the ways they would wrestle with that text was an exciting thing to be around for and take home.
Yeah, I think I can commiserate with all these different perspectives. One thing I would add is it also gave me a great desire to go back abroad. I wouldn't even let this say often, and I have a list of many options, and none of them are in the United States. Just the desire to learn more, because once you get a little bit, only spend a month in many countries, you can't just be there for a month, you have to be there for a while. It's hard to just be there for a little while and leave, because it's so much tempting to go far deeper into the culture, so wanting to learn more.
Can you talk about the cost of the program and how they're paid? The reason is, you know, there's some parents in this room. I'm one. And, you know, I have four kids, and they all want to go abroad. And then some of them have already. And some of them want to go more and do this and that. And I'm also on the Board of Regents at California Lutheran University. And so we have to make resource allocations. And sometimes these things are really expensive, but I think, as you're stating, they're very much worth it. So can you tell me how the finances kind of worked, and if, is it really worth all of the money? Because there's a lot of money here, both from a parent standpoint, your own work standpoint, and from, you know, the school allocating resources to make it happen, because it's not easy.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, I could talk about that. Global semester is very expensive. Some people in our group were working three jobs for several summers just to pay it off. Some people obviously did not feel that burden. Their parents put everything, and they spent a considerable amount of time shopping. But in terms of it's worth it, yes. I mean, however much you can do to get yourself there, it's definitely worth it. And the opportunity for global semester is you're never going to be able to do this kind of trip for less than what you're going to pay through most schools. So if you can get through a program like that, you have this opportunity and you should take it.
St. Olaf had small scholarships you could apply for. I think it was, when I did it, it was $1,000. And so that made my parents feel better about helping me. Yeah. My older sister, she went to Germany, and it was a lot cheaper. So then I came along, and I was like, guess where I applied and got in. So.
Yeah,
but they said, well, that's it. You get one chance. I don't know.
Yeah.
Can I say something about cost?
Sure.
St. Olaf is one of the schools that does, quite typically in our graduating class, 75 to 85% of students have gone abroad at least once. And we offer a lot of different kinds of programs. So even though you have before you three people who went a global semester, you shouldn't think that that's everybody. It's 28 students a year. We have four programs that are 4 to 5 months long. But like the program you did in Germany, we have those kind of programs. We have interim programs. We have study service programs. And I think you find that in all the schools that there are different kinds of programs. The global semester is really an encounter program. You know, you go and you encounter something, and just when you think you've figured out the bus system, it's time to move on. You know, and oh, now it's a subway, and you know, it's like that. But there are other programs that are much more immersion programs. Often the immersion programs cost less than the encounter programs. The per day cost for a January program is probably higher than the per day cost for a longer program. So the point is that there are lots of variables, and what is, if you want to put it in these kind of terms, what's most cost effective has a lot to do with the individual student and where they are, what it is they want to get. Sometimes just that first exposure to a place that awakens your imagination is really, really important. But for some students, that's not enough. And when we were doing selection for our global semester group, there was one guy we put on the wait list because he just kept talking about homestays. There is no homestay on this program. If you come on this program, you're going to be unhappy because we don't have a homestay. Go on a homestay program. We've got lots of homestay programs. So I obviously the money is something. When I was a student at Kelleher, I went to Japan, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and I remember thinking it was so much. It was like 25% of a year's tuition. We won't say in you know how many. There were fewer zeros.
Don't worry.
But it was. It seemed like so much money. But the way that short journey changed my openness to things. One of the students in Greta's group came to my office a few weeks after we were back and said quite a remarkable thing. She said, everyone tells you global semester changes your life, but what I know now is it'll only change my life if I let it. So there's a lot about what happens when you come back and how you respond. You could go and do that and come back and just be the same person. You know, you could just cut it off and say, not everyone is like an American, alas. Too bad for them.
Not our generation.
Maybe not, but since I've been at St. Olave, I've heard a student say that.
And like the openness she was saying, it not only opens up your heart and your mind, but it also opens up your opportunities in the rest of the world. And you've represented your school while you're abroad, too, and that's important.
Let's go, Bob, and then we'll work across this way.
Yeah, my kids have had semesters abroad at seven different schools, in Carleton, one in Occidental, in Southern California, and basically didn't cost anything for a semester abroad through the school. I mean, master's in Prague for a semester, and it costs less to go to school at Charles University than it does to go to Occidental. So Occidental's happy to pay for your tuition. It costs an airfare to get over there. Basically, it's if you're at one of these expensive schools anyway, like St. Olaf, it doesn't cost any more. And it's if the program is through the school, that's one of our programs. Yeah, that's the same deal. And plus, you know, sometimes they give you stipends for this or for that. So if you've already committed to paying for college, travel I think can be a very inexpensive option.
Sir.
Yeah, I had a question about language, but I was a student in Germany, 83 to 84. As far as cost, it meant I had to do an extra year of college because I didn't get enough credit to transfer, but that was what happened. What I found, it was interesting that everyone thinks the United States is so violent because in 83, 84, that's what, you know, oh, it's so violent over there. Everyone's dying, guns everywhere. Well, not in our house. And the question back then was, do you like Reagan? No. If you like Reagan, oh, then we don't want to have any good deal. The question I had was, I'm guessing with a couple of you, you had some language skills that you picked up. And so with me, it's been a struggle to keep the German alive. How do you, because part of this is to keep that language so you can, like, maintain contact with that part of the world in their own language. So, how do you do that?
I'm going to interject because my question relates to that.
Okay.
That I've often heard travel is one thing, but until you really study a language, you don't really understand the culture. So I was wondering, in the places where you were, if you did learn the language, traveling to a dozen countries would be a challenge. But.
Greta and I both speak German. She's a German major. And I had taken it since sixth grade before I went. Didn't really care about until college. Picked up most of it on a couple of my first journeys over there. And then I really got into it and studied it. And since I've been back, it's really hard. I came back in a rush like I had to catch up in my semester, and I was just like, I need to be with my English speaking friends, and I hadn't spoken German for 5 months until I came here, or a couple of random German friends. But there's a couple German girls here. That's been really nice. Otherwise, I'll call up my friend and speak in German. But that doesn't work very well, so.
It's expensive.
It is very hard to keep a language going. And during the global semester, we didn't really get a lot of chance to learn the actual languages. Most intensive was Arabic, and that wasn't fantastic. But in terms of German, you come back and you're all of a sudden, nothing is German and there's no relation at all. If you, when you're in Germany, there is English there. So you can speak English, you can get along without any German. I had a month, the host family there, and they only spoke German to me. So, and that was the best thing that ever happened for a language. I mean, that's the best thing you can ever do for a language, is to go somewhere and not speak any English at all. But you lose it so quickly. Came back and spent a semester without a German class, and it was very, very hard to get back into it.
Chinese is fabulous because there's so many Chinese in America now, and I've always been able to find tutors, and they have fun. They don't charge me much. And, it's classes that most, I've taken some university classes now, and so it's just becoming so widespread, so I've really enjoyed it, and it definitely added to my time there significantly.
Yeah, Greta's been much better at keeping up Chinese than I have at the Arabic that I learned. It wasn't required for my job, but it really helped in terms of understanding the people I worked with, the culture there, learning some Arabic. And I've had a hard time keeping it up, really. It's pretty tough to keep it going.
Oh, in response to your question in the back, I was thinking about it. Remember how I said at the beginning there were groups of Americans who lived quietly and groups of Americans who lived like Americans? Well, part of that distinction that came along with that is who spoke more German. The kids who only wanted to speak German with each other, even though they were Americans, definitely lived quietly and didn't want to be American, whereas the ones who were just learning German for the first time were less quick to adapt to the culture and weren't doing that as well, even. Actually got in trouble a couple times.
In my time, they spent a lot of time at McDonald's. The one where I lived. They drank Budweiser that they get off the American military base.
Beer defiance. Yeah, sir.
I'd like to talk a bit about my experience. I lived in Israel for a year. That is, I lived on the Jewish side. And so, and supposedly I'm Jewish, they're supposed to be my people, and guess what? It was just as hard to get along with them, especially since I actually do kind of, but I also managed to learn Hebrew quite well, and I still use it, but mainly for reading purposes, not so much for speaking. That's one of the same thing with German. I majored in German, and I still use it sometimes for reading purposes, not as much as I do Yiddish. That's another problem that kind of got in the way of my German, because Yiddish is so similar, it's a language I'm really committed to keeping alive. But I still occasionally read German. I'll be willing to talk German to anybody who wants to talk or Spanish, or if we're any Yiddish or Hebrew speakers here. I know that they're scholars, as opposed to spell.
Thank you.
Some of you mentioned the relationships you made along the way. In 1976, I went to Australia for 7 months, and there were six of us, and we worked with the Lutheran Church of Australia. And, you know, and a few of you mentioned some of those relationships. Could you just talk about those and what that meant to you? You know, you touched on a few different areas, but I'd just be interested.
I had a few close friends in China, Chinese students that either worked or were students at the university. And It made a big difference for me because I wasn't married at the time. I would have been lonely, I think, if I hadn't had them. So they were just good friends, close to my age, and so that made it, just helped in living there for 2 years to have friends. And so we went shopping together, and now we write emails and send photos.
Yeah, a small number of close friends, I would say, from my time there, too. But got to know my coworkers, became very good friends. Some of them are still people that I keep in touch with. The time would have been pretty bare without that, I think. I mean, that was so central to getting, I guess, comfortable in the place, making it feel like home for a little while, was having people from that place who were friends I could really share things with and you know, really learn from there, too. So. Yeah, it's one of the best parts about it.
Yeah, I traveled in a group, so I became very close friends with the people who were on our trip, but also observing people in our group who are a little more outgoing than I was, they would make friends with anyone on the street, several people in particular. They would just find somebody at one of the universities we were staying at, and all of a sudden they'd be invited to their house and they'd be eating frogs that their mother made. And so it was very fun to watch it. And a lot of it, I have to admit, it had to do with being female in a foreign country. It was harder to be outgoing and to have those connections made, especially in Egypt and India. So. And that did make a big difference. But yeah, it's very easy, and people still make, another person in my group was back in Egypt this summer and staying with friends that she made there, and they still go out every night, and it's just amazing, because this is a short amount of period you spend in each country. They're so willing to, they love to make friends, and they're very welcoming.
I miss my friends a lot, and I'm sure they're all really mad at me right now because they don't know I'm in a remote wilderness camp. And I had a really hard time keeping up with them after I got back into school too, so whereas life was a little slower there, they don't really understand that I have zero time to write a letter or even a note. I feel bad because they were really neat people from all over the world, especially the people I lived with. It was awesome. I can come and be like, this is my friend from Cameroon, Miguel. And or my philosophy friends were from Egypt and Poland and Germany. But I did go there with a prior connection. I had a family that I knew pretty well and met up with them a few times. And that was really nice because I felt like I did have a sense of home outside of town when I was living alone. And the American friends, it's really easy to stay in contact with them via Facebook. And they're still there, too. I also, if I had stayed longer, I wouldn't have been here. They'll come home next month.
Jody?
I want to see if I get you to think a little bit more about what you bring back, particularly to your college university setting. I teach at Northwestern, and a lot of our kids go off. And I see sort of three categories when they come back. One, I'm grateful for all of them because they've shown some initiative to get out of Northwestern and to go someplace else, experience something new. And when they come back into your classes, you know, they're willing to take you on. They're willing to get into discussions with you from a sort of standpoint of having been someplace and seen something. So they don't sort of kowtow to you just because you're supposed to be a professor, which I really love. I think, though, there's a distinction, at least among the Northwestern students. Those who have a wonderful experience but who are least changed by it, I think, are the students who have a kind of university-to-university exchange, where their experience in other countries is basically as a student at another university, Europe or Australia or someplace. And it's a wonderful experience, but they tend to be less changed, I think, than those students who have some kind of an encounter or an immersion experience. And among those students who have encounter or immersion experiences, there are, I see, at least two subgroups. And it has to do with the parts of the world that they're in, basically, and somewhat with the length of the stay. But the kids at Northwestern who come back and who really keep the conversation going and then tend to get involved in community stuff in Chicago and keep it moving, are the kids who've been to Latin America, Central America, Africa, India, Southeast Asia, the Philippines, the developing world, right? That something has happened to them that shifts their perspective in really, really significant ways. Mm-hmm. The students who have had immersion experiences in Europe or Australia, UK, have also had wonderful experiences, but have a little bit less jarring re-entry, right? And therefore don't, it's my observation anyway, don't need each other as much. So we got a lot of conversations going between those students who've had deep experiences in the developing world, wondering what in the world that's all about, how it relates to them as Americans, than we do with anybody else. Does that resonate with you guys at all? Is that something?
Yeah,
yeah.
When I went on global, I went as a sophomore because I just didn't have any direction and I didn't have a major. It helped me become interested in, I didn't really know what I was interested in, but I ended up with a political science major just because the courses had the names of these countries that I've been to and I wanted to learn more. And so it definitely just, it got me engaged in my classes much more significantly. I started enjoying going to classes and was thoroughly interested.
I went on the Global Semester Program as a senior, and so there wasn't as much time at St. Olaf to do things differently. But I know that when I came back from my my time abroad and started seminary, and the first thing I did was kind of seek out the group on campus that was interested in international concerns. And I mean, it had almost died there. It just so happened there were like three or four of us my year who came in who were interested in getting it going again. But and they all actually had similar kinds of experiences abroad that had led them to that. It wasn't purely an academic sort of thing. So I think I know that it had a real effect on the way I approached seminary for sure.
Yeah. Like what? Say a little bit how.
Well, the Seminarians for Peace and Justice group ended up being a real kind of home for me within the seminary community, and a place where I could gather with classmates and we prayed about concerns in the world and try to coordinate different efforts on campus and off campus. And I mean, that really was a pretty, that ended up being one of the best parts of seminary for me, was being a part of that. Ended up really kind of holding things together and being a place where I could bring in Bible and theology and everything else and look at it in conversation with concerns of the world. So.
Good. Do either of you want to respond to Jody's before we take another?
Well, my roommate this last semester spent her fall in Tanzania, and this spring, she and my roommate, we would spend hours just sitting in our room talking and comparing our experiences in Tanzania and with India and mostly Egypt. This is the third world encounter immersion experiences. So it is true that you, when you come back, you do have a connection with people. Another friend of ours spent the semester in England, and it was very interesting just to have her disposition to what we had experienced over that same time period. So it does create a connection between, it's very, they are very different experiences. So this is support of your theories.
And I'd agree with your theories too, except for the school to school, when it's university into another university, it's screened out again by the language, what skills you had when you went there, because the people who already had the language were ready to immerse in the culture, whereas the other kids were just kind of doing their thing. They weren't so proactive about learning about the other culture because they were stressed out with the language in the first place.
Yeah.
And then, just to say it shortly, like, I don't think I'll go back to Europe for a while. Next travel is somewhere else.
Yeah, back in the back here.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, concerning like expectations. You guys who spent a longer time in China and Palestine, two places that are obviously extremely different, you know, it's for a long period of time. How did you kind of prepare yourself for a place that you really can't know anything about without spending time there before? And what was the thing that kind of like smacked you in the face when you got there that was so different, you know? And how did you adapt to that? And then also coming back to the U.S., what do you have any difficulties readjusting? You both spent 2 years, right?
I'm little. I've never. I don't have big culture shock problems. I grew up in a military family, so it wasn't a big deal. Like going back and forth, it wasn't that hard. The toughest for me was the pollution in the city. I was a runner before I went, and it was really awful to run and like smell bad, and you know, it kind of hurts. Also, I got. I don't know what to say. I got a really bad acne in China, and it was just awful. And I also gained weight because the food was really good. So I came back, and my mom. And I came back in the middle. I was supposed to stay, but it was the SARS year, so they sent us home for a couple months. And I said, and my mom was kind of looking at me, but being polite. And I said, I know, I got fat, and I got zits. And she said, you're not fat.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I could have prepared better for it. I didn't do all that much. I mean, I did some reading and stuff like that beforehand, but I found that the best I could do is kind of go in, I think, with a pretty good open mind and say I'm going to, you know, do my very best to soak things up and not come in with too many preconceptions about things. And I suppose there's definitely culture shock involved. I'm trying to think about that. I mean, travel there itself was a really difficult thing. I mean, it's a country that's pretty cut up right now in terms of getting from one place to another, and traveling between the West Bank and Israel was a difficult thing to get used to. Gosh, I found that learning a little bit of language really, really helped with that. I mean, it helped me start to track a little bit with things better there, I think, and it also, people would receive me differently if I spoke a little bit the language to them, too. Coming back, I guess one thing that helped me too, part of the ELCA's arrangement for the kind of overseas service I was doing, we have to speak at a few churches that were supporting you financially when you come back, and so I had a number of places to speak, and that I think helped me process things in some way, putting together a presentation and having to talk about what it was like to people. I think doing some kind of deliberate processing of that sort really helped.
So we're just about done, and I want to have each of them respond to one forward-looking question. And maybe a fun way to pose it is, imagine that you're an advisor to whoever is elected president, and you're going to tell them, if we're going to change for the better how America interacts with the world, we should do X. John, from your experience, what would you recommend to the future president in helping the U.S. Do better, so people aren't like, "Ooh, are you a are you supportive of the president? Oh, okay, I can't be your friend."
Is this a question that you're going to give a couple hours over to? Or?
I think I have a short answer, making him promise or her that it will be the choices that we make are for the betterment of the world and not just our country. Hmm. And so having that in mind, and also very long-term goals.
I would agree with that. And just the amount of, like, we think we're being sneaky with a lot of this stuff, but people really, it's very clear that we're not doing it for other people's interests, it's all for our own interests. A lot of the financial deals and economic, the way we treat people economically, especially if you look at India and outsourcing, and that's a very mixed boat reaction there. But just being aware that people aren't blind, they can, the rest of the world sees us as we are, and to really consider that the way we show ourselves to the world needs to be consistent and honest about what we are and who we are, and that, yes, we are corrupt in a lot of ways. There are a lot of things that are not right, but we need to face those facts and own up to it.
I would say work for
cooperation with countries like China on environmental issues. And
welcome back to you. I would say be a better listener. I think the perception I came up against time and time again there was that the U.S. sees itself as us and everybody else as them. I think anything the U.S. can do to become more part of the real world community rather than kind of standing against in terms of its policies and its and the attitude it presents would be a huge thing. That was pretty present in the Middle East when I was there. That'd be a very good thing.
But also I wanted to say the language that the government uses I think is important. It's so easy to do like China bashing or any country bashing really, and often unproductive. I think it's a good it's good for non-government organizations to do it, to take strong stands, but I don't think the government needs to care for its language.
Great. Well, let's thank them for helping meet us.